Good morning. The title of my talk is Reclaiming the Core, Education for Social Beings and Idea Creators. I confess that I borrowed the phrase social beings and idea creators from the 2016 conference theme of the National Council of Teachers of English. The phrase struck me because it is so obvious. Of course, students and teachers are social beings. Of course, they are idea creators. And yet the phrase is surprising because the concept of teachers and students as people living their lives in classrooms, thinking and creating together, has become a quite radical notion in our current educational climate. I will only tangentially weed through the current debates about educational policy because I want to focus not on what is wrong with our educational system, but rather on a vision of what is possible, an entirely different notion of educational reform. I will introduce you to some of the teachers that I have been working with here through the National Writing Project in New Hampshire, who are creating curricula that are deep, flexible, integrated, and grounded in local context. And I will conclude by talking about the kind of teachers we need and what they need in order to do their work wisely and well. But before I do that, I would like to present an image. In a second grade classroom in Antrim at the end of April, a pair of boys was working on a poster about littering. They had created a rough draft which showed a bearded figure throwing a spray can at a tree. A red slashed circle hovered over the figure's head. As I passed by their workspace, I remarked on how interesting the drawing was. One of the boys informed me, "Well, we've made some changes. We decided to ditch the beard." His partner was sketching eyes on the face in the final draft. The outline was clearly defined and clean-shaven. "We decided to make him a teenager," the first boy explained. The other boy moved on to fashioning a curl on the forehead of the final draft figure. He penciled in a smiling mouth. "Wait," said his partner. "He shouldn't be smiling. He's littering." "Oh, yeah," said the other boy, erasing the mouth. His partner tried a straight line mouth. The boys considered it. They discussed for a few minutes how the mouth should look. They didn't want the figure to look too happy, but neither did they want to present their littering teenager as malicious. They considered evil eyebrows, but decided that most people who litter aren't villains, they're only careless. When I returned to check on them later, the poster was nearing completion, but the mouth was still missing. They were still trying to get it right. Before these pairs of second graders had started designing their final drafts, their teacher, Liz Lawler, had demonstrated her own revision process, showing them her rough draft poster and having them notice the changes that she'd made to her final copy. They had previously discussed what made a poster effective and had listed those characteristics on a chart which hung on the classroom wall and to which they referred frequently. So much went on in that small interaction that I observed between those two boys, which speaks to what happens when children are seen as writers, as social beings, and as idea creators in a 21st century classroom. So I want you to hold that image of those two boys in your mind as I talk about the current climate of educational reform. The Common Core standards constitute one educational reform which is probably familiar to most of you. They have become quite a polarizing issue, characterized as everything from the solution to all educational problems to a communist, for those on the right, or a corporate, for those on the left, takeover of education. There's a lot of religious fervor on either side. And while there is validity to the concerns, if we clear away the political debate and look at the standards themselves, we can see their potential to provide a crucial opening for teachers. These standards differ from previous ones in that they don't focus on content, but they focus rather on critical thinking skills. They ask that we teach students, for example, in the words of an anchor standard for writing, to, quote, write arguments to support claims in an analysis of substantive topics or texts using valid reasoning and relevant and sufficient evidence. I actually selected the shortest one, but it's still quite long. The standards ask students to write arguments, but they do not specify the subjects or the topics of those arguments. They ask that we teach students to, in the words of an anchor reading standard, analyze how and why individuals, events, or ideas develop and interact over the course of a text. But they do not specify which texts we need to use in order to do this. This has the potential to take the focus of education off of the mastery of particular information and towards a focus on how we think, analyze, synthesize, raise questions. In other words, we can focus on how we think about and what we do with content rather than on the acquisition of particular information. Many teachers describe the Common Core as a new way of doing what we have always done, a repackaging that simply makes the standards more difficult and harder to reach. But I think that to look at them in that way limits our vision. While the potential of the Common Core is great, the reality of its implementation has been far less so. While the shifts these standards represent have potential, there are also definite problems, which I will outline very briefly here. First, they were generated with almost no input from teachers. Instead, the group that created them, the National Governors Association and an organization called ACHIEVE, founded in 1996 by a bipartisan group of governors and business leaders heavily funded by the Gates Foundation, was mainly comprised of representatives of ACT and the College Board, or in other words, the testing industry. And while President Obama and Secretary of Education Arne Duncan often say that the standards were adopted voluntarily by states, in fact, states were ineligible to apply for Race to the Top funding unless they adopted the standards. Thus, they rejected them at great cost. More importantly, for teachers, there is nothing voluntary about those standards. And for as good as they might be, for many teachers, they feel imposed and disempowering. The problem has been exacerbated by the implementation of the Common Core. The standards were never field tested before students were examined on them this spring, despite the fact that the standards had barely been implemented. During the time we were supposedly introducing the new standards, students continued to be tested on the old ones. This seems unfair to both students and teachers and might lead us to question the intentions of the entire enterprise. Because there were no educators on the panels that developed the standards, they were developed by setting end standards for college and career readiness and extrapolating them back to early childhood. Thus, many of the standards at the lower level are developmentally inappropriate for many young children, turning kindergarten into a no-nonsense academic boot camp. Kindergartners, for example, are expected to, quote, demonstrate command of standard English capitalization, punctuation, and spelling when writing, end quote. They are also expected to read emergent reader texts with purpose and understanding. That's not the kindergarten I remember. These skills might once have been expected much later, and not all children are ready to meet them. Yet states and districts are not allowed to modify the standards except to add additional standards which would make the standards more rigorous. By far the most egregious problem with the Common Core is the testing and how the results of those assessments will be interpreted. In fairness, devising assessments for high-level thinking skills such as those embodied in the Common Core is incredibly difficult. The kinds of thinking skills resist standardized measurement,
because the essence of critical and creative thinking is that it tends to be divergent, to approach problems in different ways from dissimilar and often original perspectives. The results of critical and creative thinking are often novel and unpredictable. This doesn't work well in a test which requires a single right answer for each particular item. Even considering this caveat, the tests that accompany the Common Core have some serious problems. As I am not allowed to examine the actual tests, I base my opinion on the sample tests which are available to take online. A friend of mine, who also has a PhD, joined me in taking the fifth grade reading language arts test, or rather in working through the first reading selection and its associated questions. As this had taken us about an hour, we abandoned our efforts. Most of the items were so vaguely written that we could not arrive at the answers. On one item, where we agreed that only one choice was possible, we felt that the remaining item represented an oversimplification and misreading of the passage. On another item, we were unable to eliminate any of the choices. And one, which asked us to select two of the items, clearly had, in our mind, four choices, which were equally plausible. Other tests set up scenarios which mimic research situations by dropping the student into the middle of the process, presenting them with sources to compare and analyze. Aside from some of the difficulties with the questions, such as the instruction to paraphrase without plagiarizing, this isn't actually an authentic task. This is not what real researchers do. And when we take into account the quick rollout, we could be forgiven for concluding that the tests were engineered to produce a high failure rate in order to reinforce a narrative about crisis in education. Our goals, such as those embodied in the standards, are lofty, and standardized measures yield numbers which provide a reassuring illusion of objectivity and stability until we peek behind the curtain, until we examine the tests the students take and what those neatly graphed results obscure. The fact that the results of these tests correlate almost perfectly with family income should also give us serious pause. For the moment, I would like to lay aside these assessments and reform narratives, as I am well aware that teachers cannot, and I would like to reimagine an education better suited for the 21st century and the very different world which our children are helping to shape. So what do we need in order to educate for the world we cannot know, which our students will inhabit 40 or 50 years from now? The 21st century has provided us with many opportunities and possibilities that have yet to touch most of what goes on in classrooms. I refer not only to using new digital tools in classroom instruction, I am talking about new cultural realities, which include those digital tools, and how they have changed the landscape of learning. I will outline a few of these changes and how they affect education. It's almost a cliche to say it, but it's really true. Our world is increasingly interconnected. Digital technology links us to people and ideas from across the globe. We hold in our hands devices that can connect us instantly to almost anything that we want to know. Information is plentiful and ever available. So where once our authority as teachers rested on the information we knew, now anyone can know anything at any moment. Where once the focus of education was on seeing that students absorbed certain information, now information is available to everyone always, and there is far more of it than anyone could ever have imagined. The sheer amount of information available is increasing exponentially. The figures are mind-boggling and hard to overstate. We now create more data in days than had been created in all of history up to 2003, and every field has to adjust to this new reality. Not only do we receive information, but we are constantly creating it. Writers are everywhere today, and they publish their content instantly. Participatory media have democratized publication and dissemination of information, eliminating the gatekeeping functions which once controlled the flow of information. Children can create and publish content on the web, and many can reach a wide audience. We can collaborate with others on digital platforms, even people we have never met and perhaps will never meet. All of this makes authentic writing instruction more important than ever. At the same time, the composition of the school population is shifting. In 2014, the public school population, for the first time, according to the Pew Research Center, became majority-minority. We also recently crossed the dubious threshold of having more than 50% of our public school children qualify for free or reduced-price lunch. As most teachers are white, middle-class females, this shifting demographic demands of them a higher degree of cultural competence. All of us, teachers, students, and citizens, need to learn how to work productively with and learn from those whose lives and backgrounds are very different from our own. We need to provide multiple points of access for all students and assume far less about any kind of common background knowledge that all students bring to classrooms. Let me diverge for a moment in order to stress that the widespread myth that some children lack experience is really simply untrue. Every 9-year-old who enters a fourth grade classroom has 9 years of life experience. To illustrate what I mean by this, I'll tell you a little story. I was interviewing a teacher from Manchester for the writing project who told me that, quote, her students didn't have any experiences because they were all immigrants and refugees. My reaction was similar. I was really puzzled. I asked her what she meant, and she explained, well, they haven't been to a zoo, they haven't been to a museum, they haven't been to Canobie Lake Park, right? They haven't been to the beach. So because they didn't have her childhood experiences, she couldn't see that they had any experiences. These children had become invisible to her because she could only see the experiences which they did not have. This is an apt metaphor for what often transpires in education. Certain children's experiences are erased while others are celebrated and acknowledged. It is up to us to understand our students' experiences and connect with them. We need to embrace and cultivate not so much the knowledge about particular cultures or particular histories as the disposition to know more about other ways of life and other ways of thinking. We also need to actively address the racism, classism, and other hegemonies that pervade our schools today. And our standards and tests do nothing to address inequalities, and in fact, they may exacerbate them. 21st century changes call for a focus on flexible thinking skills rather than on content knowledge and the amassing of information. Learners today need the capacity to think in interdisciplinary, connected ways to address the problems that face us. They need the opportunity to express themselves in writing on various platforms in order to make sense of the information and to engage in dialogue with others. They need the opportunity to collaborate, especially with those of different backgrounds, and they need to learn how to do this effectively and equitably. None of these changes are the sort that can be successfully mandated above. They depend on the quality of interactions and relationships in each classroom. To seize the opportunities that these changes present, we need a curriculum that is integrated and critical, based on the principles of inquiry, community, and equity. Teachers in New Hampshire, with whom I've worked in the writing project, have been creating what we're calling critical inquiry units that embody these principles. While these units examine a variety of topics and content, their focus is on writing. Not so much writing as a technical skill, but writing as a way of making sense of ideas, as a form of thinking, not only in narrative, argumentative, and informative ways, but in critical and creative ways. In these units, children compose a variety of text based on deep knowledge of issues that matter. I'm going to give you some examples of these units in practice at different grade levels in New Hampshire. We'll start with Liz Lawler, whose second grade classroom in Antrim we entered briefly before. She has built a critical inquiry unit around the Great Brook Woods behind her school. Her class observed animal and plant life in the forest. The students studied life under the snow through a variety of informational picture books. They drew their own cutaway drawings of animal life under the snow cover. They created trail guides and nature journals. When the snow began to melt, they gathered all the trash they could find in the woods and sorted and categorized it, representing their findings in charts and graphs. They wrote poetry and stories about the objects they found in the woods. The students created scientific drawings and documented animal evidence and tried to guess what creatures had visited their forest. Their teacher raised critical questions for them to consider, such as whose responsibility it was to take care of the land behind the school, whether undeveloped spaces should be protected in a community, and whether they should know or care about how their actions affected the natural world. As I mentioned before, on the day I visited, they were working to create anti-littering posters, which they carried on placards. They had been influenced by, you know, news reports of protest marches. So they carried them on placards, and then they placed them around the school in the areas where they had collected the most trash. So along with ecology, history, art, and environmental stewardship, they were also learning social action and democracy. Jean Robbins, a teacher in Hancock, has been doing a unit on chocolate with her fourth graders. She was inspired by the chocolate exhibit at the Mariposa Museum and the opening of Neely Cohen's Chocolate Factory here in Peterborough. The children read and compared a variety of books about how cacao beans are grown and harvested, the fragile ecosystems that support them, how a bean makes the journey to becoming part of a chocolate bar. They investigated the history of chocolate, which led to investigations of exploration and colonization, as well as manufacturing and industrialization. The class looked at chocolate in literature by reading Charlie and the Chocolate Factory and other fictional texts. They've explored the economics of chocolate production, how chocolate prices are set and who benefits, and how much cacao farmers are paid. When I visited the class, I observed the children comparing the way chocolate moved from bean to bar, as described in three different informational texts. The children had outlined how the process was explained in each book and were synthesizing their learning across the three texts. I'm going to take you into a scene from that classroom as well. At one point, a student, who I will call Carol, raised her hand with a question. Do you think these authors would look in other books to decide what to write? Jean responded, "Wow, what a great question. Let's all think about Carol's question." And she paused to give them time to think. How do you think these different authors knew what to write? One student guessed, maybe they looked in books. Another added, maybe they went to South America. Yes, Jean said, you could observe the process, you could research in books. What else could you do? A student volunteered, you could ask people who know. Jean nodded, you could interview experts. Great question. Let's all keep thinking about Carol's question. In this interaction, Jean rephrases their responses, providing more specialized language, but she deliberately keeps the question open. I will return to this interaction later as well. When another writing project teacher, Nicole Breaux, was teaching seventh grade in Manchester, her critical inquiry unit focused on the history of immigration in the city and the mills that had driven the economy there. Students wrote about their own special places, either in the city or in some cases in their countries of origin. She mapped their writing onto a Google map. They learned the history of the mills in Manchester and used interviews with former mill workers to write poems in the voices of those mill workers. They studied the mechanics of the mills and why they were created on rivers and how they were powered. They examined artifacts on a visit to the mill museum. Students addressed critical questions about whether the mills were good for the city and for the people who worked in them, and came up with answers that challenged their pre-existing beliefs. They examined the problems and benefits of immigration in a small mill city. They connected previous waves of immigration in Manchester to the current influx of refugees and people from Latin America and the Caribbean. Rick Steinhauer, who teaches English classes at Littleton High School, built his unit around the issue of the Northern Pass Project. He wanted his students to become engaged citizens, so he selected an issue for them to investigate, which was of paramount importance in the North Country. They wrote imaginative pieces, taking the perspective of the owners of a family farm in a fictitious North Country village, as well as taking the perspective, writing the same scene, taking the perspective of the PSNH officials who are trying to purchase the land. They interviewed local state senators and representatives and people on both sides of the issue. They examined representations of the Northern Pass in popular culture, music, and graphics. In the course of investigating the Northern Pass, they made connections to the Keystone Pipeline, to private enterprise, the relationship between private enterprise and state regulation, to Supreme Court cases about eminent domain, to the economics and the environmental impact of various types of energy sources, and the legal and sociocultural implications of how these issues transcend national borders. They looked at the quality of life, how a need for energy is balanced against the quality of life in a region where the population is sparse and dispersed with minimal political clout. On the day I visited, the class was debriefing a visit from a state senator from the previous class. The students had worked in themed groups, ecology, economics, health, labor, and recreation, to formulate questions. They had practiced through mock question and answer sessions. On the day of the senator's visit, each student was prepared, and the senator was faced with 26 students and an hour's worth of intense questioning. The students were not entirely satisfied with the senator's answers. A student in the front of the room began the discussion by saying, "His answers were not so precise." A student sitting next to the first one added, "He really wouldn't say if he was for or against the project. He contradicted himself. He would say, 'I take that back,' and then tell a little story in order to try not to answer." They were critical of what they perceived as his lack of specificity on this issue that they knew so much about. A student deduced that any jobs would probably go to out-of-state people because the senator had mentioned specialty jobs. The student asked, "Why would they pay people here to be trained if they already have trained people somewhere else?" Very astute question. These kinds of units differ radically from what is usually done in schools. In many commercial programs, students flit from topic to topic, none of which necessarily relate to what the students know. I examined a teacher's website based on a fifth grade reading book, which covered the following topics in the first 100 pages: weather and thunder, Native Americans on the Aleutian Islands, Satchel Paige, immigration in Ellis Island, migrant workers, the purge of the Russian Jews in the Holocaust, Chinese family customs, Jane Goodall's efforts to save African wildlife, and the midnight ride of Paul Revere. While this kind of selection might provide some breadth, the pace of the curriculum, and teachers are held to a pace when they use these curricula, the pace of the curriculum precludes teachers from being able to address these topics in any but the most superficial manner. Imagine for a minute what a 10-year-old would have to know in order to understand any of these topics in any kind of substantive way. This kind of curriculum tends to favor those students who enter school with more academic background knowledge of the kind which is valued by the school, or who have access to other sources of information. As the materials do not go into enough depth to provide a context within which to understand the content, and the curriculum focuses mainly on reading skills, which are supposedly disconnected from any background knowledge the students bring to the text, This superficial pass at a variety of topics can leave many students feeling as if they can never really understand anything that is talked about in school, or that others are in on secrets which they cannot share. It can lead them to feel stupid or to conclude that school is not for them. By contrast, the critical inquiry units I discussed earlier, developed in very different settings by writing project teachers, approach a central issue, topic, or idea from multiple perspectives, integrate science, history, sociology, creative works, artifacts of popular culture, and also consider the role of technology, health and wellness, global implications, and the connections to current events. Thus, they afford students multiple points of entry to a topic and increase the chances of connecting with students' experiences and interest. They take on an issue in depth, exploring all of its aspects. Students become authorities on the issue or topic in an integrated, connected way. Students come to know so much about something that they are able to think critically and creatively about it. They are able to question and analyze what is presented to them in text because they are working from a depth of knowledge. In addition, these units are local, embedded in, and connected to students' lives. Every one of these units took its inspiration from the community in which it was situated, allowing teachers to use local resources. Yet the local grounding of the unit did not prevent these teachers from connecting the study to wider social issues and using the local situation to help students understand and grapple with national or global questions. These units are critical in that the issues they examine have wide-ranging implications. How do we balance our responsibility to the natural environment with a need for development and growth? What are the moral and ethical dimensions of global economies? Who should have the power to make a decision that affects a local community? What constitutes a compelling greater good? These questions have wide-ranging implications. These questions affect people's lives. In order to grapple with them in relation to specific issues, we need to know not only information, but we also have to be able to analyze and synthesize that information and to articulate and define the conflicting values that these questions involve. They are questions that are as real for the teachers as they are for the students. They are questions that matter. Because teaching is intellectual and social work, we need to return teachers to their rightful place as curriculum creators. When my oldest child was in kindergarten, a class walk to nearby Fox Pond spawned an extended study of newts, pollywogs, and frogs. It was spring, and the children were interested in the life they had discovered at the edge of the pond. Soon, there were aquariums and terrariums all around the kindergarten room, filled with frogs' eggs and newts. Children gathered breathlessly around them, recording their observations. Soon, posters appeared with five-year-olds' drawings of frogs' eggs and pollywogs labeled with their invented spellings. A variety of trade books on the subject were assembled in the reading corner for children to look at and borrow. And at pickup time, the children dragged their parents over the terrariums to show them the latest developments. This teacher knew the skills she wanted to teach, but she also knew how to ride the wave of the children's interests and to teach them those skills in the context of a connection with their local community and the natural world around them. Not all curriculum can or needs to arise as spontaneously as this did, but when teachers are curriculum designers, they are free to seize the moment, to gather materials, texts, and artifacts which will allow students to explore an area of interest. They can see, as Jean Robbins did, that a chocolate exhibit and a chocolate factory were coming to a nearby town. They can notice, as Rick Steinauer did, that an issue has gripped the community and the students could join that discussion. The curriculum can thus be responsive to students' interests and obsessions, to teachers' passions, and to the events in the community and the wider world. We need to support teachers in this vital work. But sadly, the trend continues to be to micromanage what teachers do by providing ever more scripted and constrained programs for them to follow. When teachers follow someone else's program, no matter how well conceived that program may be, the territory has been mapped out for them, the investigations have been done for them, and they tend to defer to someone else's vision, parrot someone else's answers. Instead of engaging in inquiry with her students, the teacher tends to consult the answers provided in the curriculum guide. Thus, she models intellectual passivity. When we look to outside authority, we model, consciously or not, a certain kind of intellectual subservience for our students. Alfie Cohn speaks instead of the kind of deep modeling which shows our students how we think through problems, occasionally allowing kids to, quote, see us chugging down blind alleys and shifting into reverse, end quote. Real learning is like that sometimes. This intellectual fumbling is preferable to having students, in Cohn's words, grow comfortable with the idea that books are sacred texts, or with the reduction of scientific discovery to the following of recipes, or with the premise that each ethical problem has a single right answer waiting to be uncovered, or even with a vision of adults as dispensers of unquestionable wisdom. We, who are the public in the public schools, should want the kinds of teachers who create curriculum in response to their own and their pupils' interests, which raises critical, difficult, and engaging questions for children to explore, rather than teachers who deliver only prepackaged lessons created far from their local context by those who do not know them or their students. As Linda Christensen writes, teaching is an art and a science. It requires deep content knowledge. Knowledge of the students and the classroom and the community. When a teacher designs her own curriculum, she understands its design. She is able to envision the broad outlines of its organization and its internal logic. More important, the teacher owns her own intellectual authority. She has engaged in a process of conscious choosing. This choosing extends to the fact that teachers are not only creators of curriculum, they are curators of curriculum. Curation in this context means managing and arranging a collection of texts and artifacts related to a particular theme, as is done when preparing a museum exhibit. The teacher has to select materials that will provide not dull repetition, but productive redundancy. Materials that present the same topic or issue from various perspectives in different ways. She has to arrange them in a way which invites student exploration and inquiry and use her knowledge of the territory to guide students while allowing space for them to launch their own investigations. She must enable students through their inquiry to establish their own territories of expertise. And while a teacher maps out a territory for students to traverse and demonstrates how she goes about exploring it, she does not have to know all there is to know about every inch of it. What she does know is how to think about it. The teacher has agency as a thinker, and the students appreciate that the unit is not off the shelf, but created with them in mind. The curriculum becomes responsive to them, to their lives, their schools, their communities, and the natural settings in which they dwell. These units engage both teachers and students in inquiry as a process of discovery. One of the most pernicious myths of curricular reform is the notion that we can create students who are critical and creative thinkers, poised to take on the issues which confront us as a society by positioning their teachers, the academic leaders with whom they are in contact every day, as passive executors of a curriculum of someone else's design. Teachers, for good or ill, are the intellectual models for their students, and thus it behooves us to create the conditions that will allow them to be the best models. There is a fundamental contradiction in expecting to nurture critical engagement with the world in students guided by a teacher who passively carries out someone else's plan because the textbook company or the curriculum designers are the ones who know best. Worse, these lessons are often carried out under conditions of threat, with teachers carefully monitored for their fidelity to a set program, often one which micromanages their use of time and even their interactions with students in a classroom. And far worse, teachers are threatened with termination if their test scores do not rise, as if they could make up for everything our society is not providing for our children, or they are shackled by insulting schemes of punishment and reward, as if they would not do everything they could for the children in their charge without the presence of threats or bribes. All of this is often coupled with a push for uniformity across school districts and states, in which the local context, individuality of teachers, their students, and their community are eclipsed. I have talked about teachers as curriculum creators, but I want to return to the idea of students as social beings. Because students are social beings, they can crave opportunities to interact with each other. Social factors can inhibit learning when students fail to ask questions out of a fear of humiliation. That is why what Jean Robbins does in her classroom is so important. By celebrating Carol's ability to pose a question rather than her ability to answer those questions that are posed by the teacher, Jean encourages students to take intellectual risks. She encourages them to speculate and build on each other's ideas, and thus she models a valuing of intellectual inquiry. Similarly, Rick Steinhauer's valuing of the questions raised for an authority and his acceptance of students' concerns about the answers they receive is important. Children can wrestle with questions posed by others, but they also need to be able to raise questions of their own. We need to allow them the chance to know enough about things to think deeply about them, not merely provide them with little snippets of information about unrelated topics that fail to provide the foundation for deeper thinking. As Eleanor Duckworth notes, knowing enough about something is the prerequisite for having wonderful ideas. But perhaps the idea of students as social beings is best illustrated by returning to that second grade classroom with the two boys working on their anti-littering poster. Along with learning intellectual skills, they were also learning how to discuss and negotiate, how to listen to and consider each other's ideas, how to work together in community. Their teacher told me, without laying the groundwork where children feel safe and know everyone's ideas are important and we will take care of the class together, they are not going to learn. That goal mattered to those boys because they were interested in influencing the world outside their classroom. The entire group of 7-year-olds was engaged in bringing all of their intellectual power and social passion to a project which will have an effect on something they know deeply and have come to care about. Perhaps not surprisingly, given the focus of my work, I see writing as crucial in providing opportunities for both students and teachers to hone their capacity for deeper critical thought. Writing allows students a say in their learning by helping them to develop their thinking. Writing can give all of us, students and teachers and citizens, a voice. I would like us to think about the kinds of places we would like our schools to be. Stephanie Jones, a writing project director I recently met with in Georgia, writes of the feeling of walking into a school today, which she describes as a knotting in her stomach and a speeding up of her heart, which comes from witnessing too many unconscionable things, like the public announcement of student test scores in a 5th grade class, threats to send children to a lower class if they don't work harder, kindergartners not allowed to use crayons during writing time, pre-kindergartners allowed only 10 minutes of recess, a kindergartner handcuffed and taken away. Too many classrooms, too many schools have been driven by policy directives and accompanying pressures to become inhumane places. Instead of shackling teachers with mandated materials and crushing accountability schemes, we need to provide them instead with what they need in order to be the best teachers they can be. Real educational reform would involve giving teachers professional working conditions, time for collaboration, reflection, responding thoughtfully to student work, for conducting research in their own classrooms. Access to a professional community like the National Writing Project, which supports them and helps them challenge their practices and their thinking. They need access to 21st century tools and to be treated with professional dignity in a system which recognizes that communities of dedicated teachers are essential and powerful, and which doesn't try to motivate them with offensive schemes like merit pay or threats of termination. They need reforms like the National Writing Project, which are based on core values of community, inquiry, and equity, and which communicate to teachers that we can reform our schools with the teachers we have right now, teachers who often come from the communities they serve, who have the background, the preparation, and the experience to do their jobs well. The circumstances that pertain in too many schools today make the work of the teachers I've portrayed here all the more remarkable. Despite difficult conditions, these teachers continue to go to work every day to strive to see each individual student as a social being and the idea creator that he or she is, and design learning experiences that are meaningful and important, experiences that matter. Those teachers are the core to real educational reform. Thank you.
This is the Monadnock Summer Lyceum. We do have some time for questions from the audience, and while the ushers collect them, I would like to begin by asking, you mentioned the National Writing Project. This is clearly a very, very important organization, and I would like you to, if possible, take some time to just tell our audience a little bit more about this project and its importance, please.
Well, thank you for the question. I'm delighted to answer that question. The National Writing Project is the only national reform movement which is dedicated to improving the teaching of writing in our nation's schools. And it's been around for about 40 years. The project originated in Berkeley, California, with the Bay Area Writing Project, and has spread to all 50 states. New Hampshire was actually the 50th state to join the Writing Project. We're like that sometimes. And it's based on some core principles. One is that the best teachers of writing are those who write themselves, so it engages teachers in writing. And also the idea of teachers teaching teachers, so they have an opportunity to work with the Writing Project to become teacher consultants and work with other teachers across the country.
That's wonderful. Here's a question from our audience. How would you educate teachers for this project and process that you suggest? You've said you would measure student competence as sufficient to advance in our educational system. As a retired teacher, this question would be, I think, important, not just for the retired teachers, but for also for current teachers. How would you educate teachers for this process and program?
So the question is about how to educate teachers so that they're equipped to create the kinds of units that I was talking about. I think that's a really important question. That's actually a lot of what I do at Plymouth State is prepare teachers. And we actually practice creating these units in our teacher education program so that students, by the time they graduate, will have already created several of these units. It's harder to do when you're not situated in a particular school, but they have experience with doing that. So we expect our graduates from our program to be capable of creating curriculum and not merely executing curriculum. So that's sort of built into the program. I hope that answers the question.
The next question, is there anything that can be done at the national level to correct the negative aspects of Common Core while preserving the positive aspects?
That's a really difficult question. I think the issue has become so contentious on both sides that's going to be very difficult. I'm hoping that with new leadership in the Department of Education, of course, we don't have any idea what that leadership will be, that perhaps the teachers can feel that their voices are honored. People can feel, I think one of the concerns about the Common Core, and it was a concern that I had prior to even reading the standards, was the idea that it was going to be a national curriculum that would be imposed on local areas and wouldn't allow for the kind of locally based curriculum that I've been talking about here. I think with sort of leadership and advocacy, perhaps some of those fears could be dealt with. I also think that the Common Core has to be open to be adapted and not the way that it currently is, where you're unable to change anything about it, so it can't be adapted to local circumstances.
Can you comment on the use and limitations of digital technology in the classroom?
Oh, that is such a great question. I think that the future of writing, I mean, even the present of writing, a lot of it is digital. And we have to deal with that reality or take that reality into account. But I think what we need to do in terms of teaching about and with technology is not to focus on the tools, because these tools change, and they change so rapidly that you can't keep up with them. I think what we need to do is teach students the thinking skills that they need in order to use technology wisely. I think we also have to do a better job of returning to some of sort of the core principles of writing, which have to do with taking into account your purpose, your audience, the form of writing that you're doing. I think students need those skills far more than they ever did, because publication is so easy and you reach people so quickly that you really have to think about these issues far earlier, I think, than we had to think about them in the past.
Here's one from a local retired school administrator. How do citizens influence local school boards to adapt your vision?
That's also a great question. I think the pressure has to be to support and honor the work of the teachers. I mean, I probably don't need to tell anyone that the image of teachers in the popular press right now is not very good. And I think we have to act to counter that narrative. And often that's difficult for teachers themselves to do without appearing self-interested. So I think that that's something that we as citizens need to do. And we need to raise questions when in a local school board is thinking, for example, of adopting a program that they're going to impose K through 12, I think we have to ask a lot of questions about that. Ask about, you know, where is the space for teachers to be able to adapt this program? How is this program going to be implemented? And really think about, because you could spend far less money on professional development for teachers of the kind that really empowers them. It would cost you far less as citizens than adopting some of these programs, which are really quite expensive and actually hinder a lot of what goes on in the classroom. And it arises out of a mistrust of teachers. And I think we have to trust our teachers. Not every teacher is going to be fabulous right off from the first day. It's a profession where we're expected to be fabulous from the first day, but that's very difficult to achieve. So we need to build structures and a climate in schools where teachers can support each other. And things like merit pay don't accomplish that. They pit teachers against each other, and they destroy what teachers need in order to grow and be better.
In a critical inquiry framework, what is the place, if any, of classics in literature or studying specific periods and events in history, for example, the Civil War?
That is also a great question. And it's one that, you know, we haven't had to think about specifically. There is one requirement in the Common Core for content. Now, I'm less familiar with the math standards, and so I don't really speak about those. But in the English Language Arts standards, the one requirement that they have is that they do a Shakespeare play somewhere in grades 11 and 12. So we have had teachers building their critical inquiry units around the inclusion of that Shakespeare play. And I do think that we have to think, as this becomes more widely adopted, about how we're going to ensure that kids do get certain historical background. But they don't always have to get it directly. Like, we don't, our unit maybe doesn't have to be on the facts about the Civil War. We can bring up the Civil War in a unit on something that's only tangentially related to the Civil War, but they're going to be learning about that anyway.
This is a statement and then a question. It strikes me that there is a very slow transition of the process for preparing teachers to teach. Many administrators today are at a loss of how to allow, let alone empower, this kind of teaching for collaboration. What is your sense of this tug and pull between the past, present, and future here in New Hampshire in particular?
I'm not sure I understand the question. So we're looking at new teachers who may be less able to...
I got the sense that administrators really don't know how to empower these individuals, to let them become teachers, to develop their strengths and capabilities. And I don't know that there is sufficient support for administrators or understanding of what that process is. So do you have a component that would actually train administrators to be better at empowering these teachers and supporting them? That's how I interpret the question.
Okay. That's a marvelous idea, and we would be really excited about doing that. Because I think you're right. You know, we need administrators who, you know, understand what these teachers are trying to do and therefore can provide the support. You know, and I think a lot of that support takes the form of allowing teachers to work together, to work collaboratively, and to support each other. And, you know, administrators can be excellent at facilitating that process and at bringing out the best in every teacher. And that is another direction we need to go.
That's it? One more? Okay. So this goes back to the writing project. There's a question, actually several in here, of how long the project lasts and how do you select the teachers for this project?
Oh, great question. The Intensive Summer Institute, which is really the heart of the Writing Project program, lasts 5 weeks. We just finished ours last week. And we select every year teachers from, they have to apply and they have to fill out an application form, and then they go through an interview and they're selected. So it is a self-selecting group and it is a selected group. So these are teachers who, you know, are first of all willing to give up 5 weeks in the summer for professional development, which, you know, is a pretty self-selected group. And they also are teachers who go through a really rigorous selection process in order to be selected to work in the National Writing Project. And the idea is that these teachers become teacher leaders. And many of these teachers become what we call teacher consultants, and they go out to other schools and they work with teachers to really to mentor them and to facilitate research groups or writing groups or teaching practice-based groups out in schools, either their own schools or other schools. And that's another excellent way that administrators can support the Writing Project and can support this process. We have a program in Guilford right now that's going on 2 years that is really entirely staffed by Guilford teachers who have gone through the Writing Project, and they're the ones who are providing
all of the professional development for the teachers in their district. So that's a great model, and we've had great administrative support there.
That's wonderful. Thank you. Thank you again so much, Dr. Meg Peterson, for sharing your time and expertise with us today.
Thank you.